It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we'll find out why our guest says mainstream medicine isn't taking women seriously. First, many Americans might not have a strong opinion about leaders of other countries, but the United States plays a significant role in the global economy, international agreements, conflicts, and issues like climate change and trade. As a result, many people from other countries are well aware of our president's actions and positions and have strong feelings about it. And a new poll by the Pew Research Study measured current opinions of President Trump and the U.S. from around the world. Patrick Wintour is diplomatic editor for The Guardian, and he joins us now. Patrick, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you very much.
Well, Patrick, what does this recent Pew study show?
Well, it shows that the levels of support for President Trump in terms of whether he's the kind of person you would have confidence in terms of how decisions be taken for the world. In Europe, the levels of confidence have absolutely plummeted. I think in Spain, the figures are something to the effect of 6% of Spanish people would have confidence in him. The figures in Germany are 20%. In Britain, it might be 40%. And you get further into Eastern Europe, it might be just over 50%. But the numbers are of a level that we have not seen about an American president since George Bush at the time of the Iraq War. So by contrast, confidence in a figure such as the German Chancellor Angela Merkel are way higher, and even at some points people feel that Putin would be a better world leader than Trump. And I think even in Canada, you would assume as a neighbor to America, confidence in Trump is so low that he's in a negative territory.
And you use the word plummeted, which obviously suggests there's been a change here. How does this compare to previous presidents, looking at President Obama, and if there's any earlier data points there?
Well, the main data point would be Republican to Republican, which is obviously George Bush. And I think obviously a feature of President Obama's presidency was his attempt to reach out to Europe. He made a well-known and famous speech at the Brandenburg Gates in Berlin, trying to say that America understood European values, and there was a commitment to NATO, a commitment to the idea of the European Union, and then a commitment to free trade, and just broadly more kind of liberal values in line with where most Europeans are. So I don't think there was any problem during the Obama presidency in terms of him having kind of public support in Europe, but the variety of things that President Trump has done since his president has just obviously changed that very quickly. And it's also had an impact about whether people feel strongly about America itself and American values, because it's had a bleeding effect into the way in which people view American values.
And what are the findings there?
Well, I mean, the variety of figures are, but broadly down by about 20%, showing that American values around liberty, freedom, have all sort of declined, and sort of concerns about even whether Americans are selfish society, whether it's a violent society, just perceptions of a country are seen through the prism of a president. And whether that's right or wrong, that is how people tend to view a country, because people, say, in Europe think, well, President Trump was elected by the American people, so the fact that he's saying what he's saying must reflect what American people think and feel.
Now, you touched on Canada earlier, and there was an interesting point about Canadian opinion, and I guess a first for history, about whether the U.S. is a force for good in the world. What changed there?
What's changed in Canada is I don't think any different from what's happened in any part of Europe. And obviously, you can have whatever view you have about Trudeau, but he's taken a different attitude to refugees. He's been a very welcoming country, and to refugees, taken quite big political internal risks about that, made very big public displays that he wants refugees to come to Canada. He doesn't think they're a security threat. He thinks they are add value to society. And in the end, the opposite is what's being proposed by President Trump, who tends to see immigrants as a security threat, whether it's from Mexico or from mainly Muslim states in the Middle East.
And right now we're speaking with The Guardian's Patrick Wintour about a recent Pew poll that shows that 75% of people from other countries, this is a 37-country survey, have little or no confidence in President Trump. And we've been hearing about how that extends to attitudes about the United States in general. And Patrick, the U.S. has had a kind of a special relationship and partnership with the United Kingdom. What kind of response did Pew find there with someone who would have been considered a close ally historically?
Well, there's the same drops occurred. It's not plummeted quite to the extent to who we've been talking about in Germany or in, say, Spain and Italy, but it's declined markedly. And in fact, there's been this whole debate about whether President Trump is going to come on a state visit, which would be, in essence, at the invitation of the Queen. And that invitation has been extended very early on in the Trump presidency by the UK Prime Minister. But since then, there's been silence as to when it's to occur. There's been suggestions that President Trump recognizes he shouldn't come if it's going to lead to massive protests and that which would embarrass the Queen. There's even been suggestions he'll come on a very brief visit because there's a window between the moment when there's something called the G20, which is when all the world leaders meet in Hamburg at the end of this week. And then he's also agreed, President Trump's also agreed to go to France on Bastille Day, which is the 14th, and there was some suggestion he might try and creep into Britain on a very secret visit, or even go to one of his golf courses in Scotland. So then there are loads and loads of left-wing people in Britain, all primed for his visit, ready to protest wherever he goes. So it's a kind of it's a game of cat and mouse going on now, because no one's quite clear whether he would come for that very brief window.
Now, we've been talking about this change in opinion, a lot of the world seeing President Trump in a negative light. Did the study drill down to look at what it was in particular that is troubling people about the president? Do we know how they're thinking of him and why it's so negative?
Well, they see him as a strong leader, which arguably he is, but they also see him as dangerous and unpredictable. I think that is what's really troubling people, is both in the kind of foreign policy community, I think just in the general public, is that they don't quite know where American policy is going on any major issue. And from one day to the next, there's confusion. At the moment, there's a huge dispute going on in the Gulf, which is incredibly important both to the UK and America about a fallout within the Gulf states. And within America, and I can certainly say this is true of the British Foreign Office, there is no understanding of the position of the American government. There's one view being expressed by the State Department and another view being expressed by the White House. And that makes it very difficult to have sort of kind of secure relationships with America, because you don't know from one minute to next who is making the decisions. So unpredictability, dangerous, is the kind of main kind of concern about President Trump. Even that he might also be kind of emotional and selfish is another kind of that America. He adds this sense that America is now a selfish nation rather than a kind of multilateral nation, that it thinks only of itself. And this phrase, America First, which he's propagated, has now meant that other people say, well, if he puts America first, we're going to put Europe first, in contrast.
Right.
Sorry, go on.
What does that mean? You know, you talk about President Trump's America First stance, and, you know, the White House might listen to this conversation and say, well, exactly, this America First stance is not meant to win a popularity contest abroad. It's meant to put America first. So should the White House, should the president be troubled by these findings?
No, that's a perfectly fair comment, which I think, you know, maybe people in Europe don't think about enough, which is that he's got his own constituency, and that many, many American people feel that they've been paying out for the defense of Europe via NATO, that they've been accepting unfair trade deals with Europe, that broadly they've been paying for European security for too long. And I think actually many Europeans think that's a legitimate argument, and it was actually also put by President Obama, but in a much more mild way. But the way in which it's being portrayed by President Trump is leading some European politicians, including Merkel, to say that there is now a long-term change in the relationship between America and Europe, and Europe is going to have to look after itself much more. But the most, I think the real thing that's caused the greatest anger and anxiety is the fact that America's pulled out of this climate change treaty that was signed at Paris only a year and a half ago. And the danger is that if America takes this non-leadership role on this issue, other countries either will follow America so the whole climate change agreement collapses, which I don't think is in America's interest, or, and this point is put to President Trump by figures like the new French President Emmanuel Macron. He says that the moral leadership of the world extraordinarily will move from America to China, and China is quite welcoming that possibility. Many Chinese experts I speak to say that China is now a much more active player in the world than it used to be. And it relishes the fact that America is becoming a more isolationist country. And we're talking about trends that can last 10, 20, 30 years. And these could be long-term changes where America loses its acknowledged moral leadership of the world. And that has huge implications.
We're speaking with The Guardian's Patrick Wintour right now, talking about a recent poll that shows that 3/4 of people from other countries have little or no confidence in President Trump. And we're seeing corresponding dips in perceptions of the United States in general. And we want to know what you think at 800-642-1234. Do these poll results surprise you? Do they concern you? Or maybe if you're a fan of President Trump's America First policy, do they encourage you maybe about his stance? And what implications can you see for the United States because of this dip in global opinion? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And we'll continue our conversation in just a little bit. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert. And we're continuing our conversation with Patrick Wintour about the overwhelmingly poor global public opinion about President Trump and also the United States, seeing a dip there as well, and whether this matters. Patrick is the diplomatic editor for The Guardian. And we'd like to hear from you on this at 800-642-1234. Does it surprise you that people in 37 countries, many of them, all but actually two, had such a poor opinion of President Trump? Do you think that that should matter to the president, to the White House, and to the American people? And what impacts, good or bad, could you see coming down the pike as a result of this? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Patrick, I mentioned two notable exceptions to this dip in perception of the president. And there were two countries there that did not line up with this. What were they?
Israel and Russia, which are not totally surprising, although the Russian thing is fascinating given the long-term kind of issues between Russia and America in the past. And I think the hope that was very strong inside Russia that Vladimir Putin, that there was going to be a new beginning between America and Russia as a result of President Trump's election. And that's been obviously kind of had a bit of a false start due to the revelations or accusations about what the help that President Trump got to become elected from the Russian state in terms of the interference in the American elections, of which, you know, some is proven, some is not proven.
Mm-hmm. And any thoughts about Israel?
The issue has been that the last year or 2 years of the Obama administration, there have been an absolute collapse in relationship between Israel and America, and very strong allegations about continuance of settlement building in Israel, refusal to engage in the peace process. And it led to some very nasty exchanges in the final months. There was a belief, I think, in Israel that Trump is much more sympathetic to the Israeli cause than Obama. But at the same time, Obama, you know, had a kind of peace plan, which I'm not sure the new American administration has a even clear plan about what to do. So it's a kind of expectations issue, really.
And let's take a caller now. We've got Brad joining us from Duluth, Minnesota. Brad, hi.
Hi. Yes, I just had a thought and a question. First, I'm appalled that we would have elected someone so ridiculously unqualified. I don't think we've been this unstable since the 1930s, and I'm not surprised that the world is seeing this. Do you have any thoughts about history and when we were last this unstable?
Brad, thanks for that. And Patrick?
When was America last unstable as this? I think it's almost unprecedented, partly because of the way in which he uses modern media to think of a president that has just shown himself to be so out of his depth as he has. Normally, presidents are secluded in one way or another. I mean, I don't think, to be honest, I don't think Ronald Reagan had a total grip on every minutiae of American policy. But he was the way in which he never put himself out in a way in which President Trump has done and shown himself to be so ignorant. And he was very, very carefully managed right to the end. And therefore, he was seen to be a kind of sunshine figure, an optimistic figure. But no one really regarded him as the kind of the key decision maker in Washington. But he wasn't seen to be dangerous or as unqualified as President Trump has proved to be. So I think Reagan would be the more recent example. But apart from that, I think America has been very fortunate in its leaders. I mean, they've all had their flaws, but in terms of absolute grip on a subject or qualified for the job, I think they were broadly so, certainly since the Second World War.
Brad, thank you so much for that call. And Patrick, on a smaller scale, does news like this about perceptions, does it make it less safe for Americans who might be traveling abroad?
Less safe? No, I think it's as safe as ever. I think there's a kind of hysteria in America that we're all about to be, that Europe is a very dangerous country. I mean, obviously, there's been most horrific bombings both here in the UK and in France particularly, but I just don't think we misunderstand the level of danger there is, and I don't think there's any sense of anti-Americanism which is going to lead to sort of violence. I think it's always going to lead to a kind of a friendly discussion about what America's doing. I'd recommend any American to come to Europe at any time and not feel fear. We are the whole of Europe welcomes America, and I think, and it's just, I think they're distressed by the president and his behavior.
You mentioned a kind of voluntary non-leadership from the United States as part of this America First policy, and you mentioned one ramification being that China could step in to fill this power vacuum. What other consequences do you see?
Well, the other very immediate one is in Syria, which I mean to be fair to the president, I don't think Obama had a very clear idea about what to do in Syria. But we've almost got to the formal point in which America has said to Russia, "You decide what to do in Syria. If you want to keep President Assad in power, that's your call." Our focus, i.e., the America's only focus, is to remove Islamic State from Raqqa and from Mosul, and to make sure they don't control any territory in either country. But in terms of which regime then takes over in Syria, I think that's now being left to Syria and to Russia. So that's been ceded responsibility. And then I suppose in looking at the other immediate crisis, North Korea, the latest sense is that the White House would like China to take responsibility and Japan, and they're looking to other countries to take responsibility for, and that would require taking decisions about oil exports to North Korea, which might lead to the collapse of the country, mass refugee crisis. Those are the other issues where you can sort of feel America sort of ceding responsibility. And I think also we're waiting to see finally whether America accepts its responsibilities in the Ukraine.
And Patrick, we've got about 30 seconds left. So what about Angela Merkel? There are some who say that correspondingly her perceived power and approval ratings are going up, maybe in response to some people looking for a leader that's not coming from the United States.
Yes, but I mean, Germany has its own history because of the Second World War. It's very kind of constrained and anxious about becoming a sort of world leader in the way some people might want it to be, and it really wants to see Europe strengthen, the European Union strengthen. So what Angela Merkel's really focused on, apart from her own re-election, is to make sure that she forms an alliance with the new French president, and that strengthens and integrates Europe. She doesn't want Germany per se to be the leading figure in either Europe or the world. She wants to be part of an alliance.
Patrick, thanks a lot for joining us today. That was Patrick Wintour, diplomatic editor for The Guardian, joined us to talk about a recent Pew Research study found that 3/4 of residents of other countries have little or no confidence in President Trump. Our next guest says the wellness industry is having a moment. From Reiki and acupuncture to yoga and cleansing diets, wellness offerings are growing and increasingly women are seeking them out. And what's more, our guest says there's a reason for women's interest in wellness. Traditional medicine, she says, doesn't take them seriously, and women's health issues are marginalized and treated as the exception, not the rule. Annalise Griffin joins us now. She's a freelance writer and co-founder and editor-in-chief of the email magazine Brooklyn-based, and she wrote about women and wellness for Vox magazine. Annalise, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me. First, a quick correction, not for Vox, for Quartz.
Sorry, for Quartz magazine. Yes, and that, by the way, is up on the Central Time Facebook page right now, so check that out. And I want to start, Annalise, by quoting from your piece. You say that the success of the wellness industry is a direct response to a mainstream medical establishment that frequently dismisses and dehumanizes women. Can you get into what you mean by that?
Well, to start with something that you know, I think that there are a lot of elements of women's health care that are highly politicized. But to start with one that absolutely isn't, look at cardiac care. Women experience heart attacks less frequently than men, but their rates of survival are lower because the symptoms that we use to identify a heart attack, the default are male symptoms, and women often present much differently. And it's taken the medical community a long time to, you know, create good public awareness around this. And that's just the first step of women not even recognizing heart attacks in themselves and in others. The second is that once you get to the hospital, women are often treated much less aggressively for heart attacks and for other trauma. than men are. When it comes to pain management, women wait an average of, I believe it's 12 minutes longer, which when you're in acute pain is a lifetime. And they're often prescribed, you know, for conditions like usually autoimmune disease and other sorts of chronic conditions, you know, irritable bowel syndrome and some other things like that. Men are, and this actually also applies to knee replacement surgery, men are given the option and guided toward more aggressive treatments more quickly than women are.
And you say that there are also examples of illnesses and disorders that are a lot more common to women, things like chronic fatigue syndrome and depression, and that the response is maybe different than you might see for a man.
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely true. Autoimmune diseases in general strike women at a much higher rate than men. We don't know why that is. But so if you take something like fibromyalgia, for example, that's a disease that has been sort of a punchline for a long time that people really, you know, seem to think is, you know, in the sufferer's head, is something that is more psychological than physiological. And that's a disease that's largely experienced by women, and it has sort of, you know, amorphous symptoms. The same thing with chronic fatigue syndrome. There are still, even though it's been disproven time and time again by many good studies, women are still prescribed, you know, relaxation and exercise and all of these things for chronic fatigue that are not actual medical treatments. They're essentially saying, this is something that's happening with your body that you have, you know, some sort of mental control over, that if you just relax and de-stress, that it will get much better, when in fact that's not the case.
Where do you think some of these attitudes are coming from, that the default is sort of male in mainstream medicine? Do you think it's coming from the fact that for a long time, and still persisting certainly in some fields today, most doctors are men? Or do you think it comes from the research industry that has not wanted to include women in research models?
Well, I think it comes from both. You know, I think that, you know, the medical field is changing and certainly support staff in hospitals and other, you know, health centers are often nurses and other you know, health professions are largely or predominantly women, which is a whole other story. But, yeah, I mean, I think that the field is definitely male-dominated. And I think that probably more importantly, the research field is male-dominated. In terms of clinical trials, in terms of drug studies, the male body is really the medical default. And that's a problem both for treatment protocols, And even for developing different types of treatment that interact differently in, you know, bodies that have different hormone levels and all of the different physiological differences.
We're talking right now with Annalise Griffin. She is a writer and editor living in Vermont and co-founder of the email magazine Brooklyn-based. And she's talking about why she says women are flocking to the wellness industry. She says it's because mainstream medicine doesn't take them seriously. And she wrote a piece about this for Quartz magazine, and that is up right now on the Central Time Facebook page. And Annalise, what does alternative medicine offer women that traditional mainstream medicine doesn't?
Well, I mean, I want to be clear that I think that our health system is overwhelmingly unpleasant for almost everyone to navigate. If that part is not necessarily totally gendered, you know, I think from the difficulty in finding a physician or a specialist of any kind who will take your insurance to navigating, you know, a whole field of specialists and how to make decisions. You know, I think that the system is overwhelmingly impersonal and difficult for people, and I don't want to sound like I think that that part is necessarily always worse for women. I think that we all struggle with it, that it's a very imperfect system. But I think that the wellness industry, you know, part of it is that it's an industry founded on making you feel good. You know, whether you're talking about, and I don't want to lump everything in the wellness industry in together. You know, I'm an avid practitioner of yoga, and I think that it does make an incredible difference for your body and your mind. You know, and a lot of yoga teachers are very dedicated to the practice and to their students. You know, at the same time, I think the whole idea of, you know, cleansing and colonics and clean eating is something that is just has everyone who's in that industry seems to me to be selling something, whether it's a book or whether it's, you know, a treatment at their clinic or whether, you know, it's just a their website and their sort of social media presence and, you know, a set of ideas that they would like to make money from. There's no proven value to most, you know, cleansing and sort of the idea that food is full of toxins and clean eating will, you know, improve your health other than the fact that you're probably eating more vegetables and fruits and less processed junk. But the wellness industry is designed to make you feel good. That's its whole purpose, whether that means, you know, you're going to a yoga studio or a massage studio or going to get acupuncture, which I also am a fan of, in which the FDA actually recently approved as a alternative pain relief mechanism, you know, intended to sort of address the opioid crisis. You know, when you go to an alternative wellness sort of provider, they make it nice. You know, they are pleasant when you walk in. You don't have to wait for an appointment that was supposed to happen at 1:15 until 3. You know, there's no surprises to how much it's going to cost. And everyone is nice to you. And I think that all those things are, you know, sorely lacking in the medical industry.
I mean, are you kind of getting it there, the patient-centered care, which doctor-patient relations, the doctor really listening and caring about you as a person and not being rushed, all of those things that are hard to come by sometimes in a very rushed medical industry?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, actually, ironically, as a woman, I think you are actually more likely to encounter that in terms of the doctors who are in the women's healthcare field. I mean, every gynecologist I've ever had, I think, has been, I mean, I've mostly gone to nurse practitioners because I think that they do have a greater ethos of patient-centered care. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in that industry or that in that part of the industry in general, once you get through all the barriers to actually seeing your doctor or seeing your nurse practitioner, in my experience, those people have generally been very caring and very interested in patients, you know, and in my health. So I do actually think that women have greater access to patient-centered care in that way. But, yeah, I think in general, it's like by the time you get to see the doctor, even if that doctor is someone who is, you know, who's interested in you and looks you in the eye and does all the right things, you've already had such a frustrating experience that may not be what stays with you.
Annalise Griffin stays with us now. She's a writer and editor, co-founder of the email magazine Brooklyn Base, and she's talking about her piece in Quartz that looks at why women are turning to the wellness industry, and Annalise making the case that in part it's because mainstream medicine hasn't listened to them and has not taken them seriously. And we want to hear from you if you're a woman. Have you looked for alternative treatments in wellness? What has your experience been like? Or did you turn to the wellness industry because you had some of these possibly difficult experiences like we've been talking about in mainstream medicine? And what was that like when you turned to something else in the wellness industry? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And we'll pick up our conversation in a little bit here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickard, and Annalise Griffin is still with us right now. She is an editor and a writer. Recently wrote a piece about why she says women are turning to the wellness industry, and she says it's because mainstream medicine hasn't listened to them, hasn't taken them seriously. And her piece, by the way, it's up right now on the Central Time Facebook page. And we want to hear from you about this. If you're a woman, have you looked for some of these alternative treatments in wellness? What has your experience been like in traditional medicine? Did you find what you needed there? Or did you end up looking somewhere else? You can call us at 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Annalise, in your piece, you do make the point that there is a sense of privilege to the wellness industry, that it's largely for privileged women who have the income to spend on this. It's not often, sometimes it is, but not often covered by insurance. And this might not be something that's accessible to everybody.
Yeah, I mean, this is, I think that the sort of figure that most represents this industry and the sort of the part of it that I'm trying to get at, you know, is Goop. Gwyneth Paltrow's, you know, started out as a website and an email that had, you know, everything from fashion advice to recipes, and she has a cookbook, and now it's become very much a wellness site, and there was just a wellness conference, which another one of my colleagues at Quartz wrote about, Jenny Avens, the same week that I wrote this. And, you know, Goop offers everything from, you know, different cleanses to a whole branded line of vitamins that are supposed to address these issues that women have, you know, from trying to watch your weight to detoxing to persistent fatigue. And one of the big ideas at Goop is, well, and first, to get back to the idea that this is something for privileged women, a one-month protocol, which is, you know, a word that they like to use a lot, of these vitamins, I believe, is pushing $100, which is, you know, that's a lot of money for a set of vitamins, which may or may not be doing anything for you. You know, and all of their products, you know, tend to be in that sort of upper range of, you know, and there's a whole sort of Goop lifestyle of organic food and, you know, designer clothing, preferably sort of breezy and linen in, you know, sort of style. And, you know, it's an expensive lifestyle. Even, you know, try to find a yoga class that costs less than $15 a class. You know, most yoga studios do have community classes and try to make them more accessible because it's part of the, you know, sort of yoga philosophy. But, you know, these are services that do cost a lot of money.
We've got a caller right now. We've got Mona on the line with us from New Richmond. Mona, hi.
Hi. I tried traditional medicine, Western medicine, and was not successful, but I've had relief from the eye movement, destabilization, reprocessing, and also acupuncture.
So you've been using a mixture of those two things.
Right. Well, I did the eye movement therapy, and then I've gone to the acupuncture, and that's much more effective.
Mona, thank you for that. And do you think that this is something that a lot of women are doing right now, either starting out in traditional medicine and using some of the wellness offerings like acupuncture as complementary, or do you think that some women are just turning exclusively to wellness? Annalise.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought that was for our caller. I mean, I think a lot of people do what she was describing, which is start out in traditional medicine, mainstream medicine, and then either supplement or turn to something else. And I don't think there's anything wrong with that, and that's certainly not what I'm trying to say in that piece. And I think that acupuncture is a great option for a lot of things, and I've used it, and I think that it can be very effective. I wouldn't want to heal a broken leg with acupuncture, but no acupuncturist would try to heal a broken leg with acupuncture either. And that is actually another sort of part of the wellness industry where there are a lot of, in the town where I live, there's a acupuncture practice that has community days. And I know that when I lived in Brooklyn, there were a few practices that had, you know, very low cost acupuncture so that it would be accessible to all. But yeah, I think that is a common thing to be doing both things.
Annalise Griffin stays with us now, writer and editor, and she's talking about why she says that women are moving increasingly to the wellness industry when mainstream medicine might be failing them or maybe not taking them seriously. Let's take another call from Kathy in Milwaukee. Kathy, hi.
Hi, I would consider myself a woman who is interested in alternative and wellness simply because mainstream medicine has completely dropped the ball on nutrition. Most doctors have one or zero courses on nutrition. And, you know, there, it's not true that there isn't research showing the benefits of healthy eating versus junk food and organic eating versus pesticide-laden food. And also stress management, the importance of stress management and in your overall health and how badly stress can exacerbate everything. And I also disagree with the guest in the sense that there was almost this suggestion that there's something shady about the fact that alternative practitioners are making money. Well, I really wouldn't expect anyone to work for free.
Kathy, thank you for that. And Annalise, what's your response?
I don't think there's anything shady about making money. And of course, we don't, you know, don't expect anyone to work for free, except for a lot of journalists, I suppose. I mean, I think that we need to draw a line, and it, you know, it's not like I want to sort these into, you know, two columns of categories, but I think that there's a lot, I think there's a lot of really good stuff in the wellness industry. I think yoga and acupuncture and stress management and exercise and, you know, healthy eating, I think all of those things are totally great and are, you know, in fact, necessary in some way. I think that the idea of, you know, like, to get back to Goop and Gwyneth Paltrow, a $90 a month vitamin regimen, when a lot of vitamins and supplements are completely unproven, is maybe, you know, trying to take advantage of what people hope they can achieve by taking pills instead of altering other parts of their lifestyle. It's a lot harder to make the time to go to yoga and to buy the organic vegetables and to eat healthily and to deal with your stress than it is to, you know, take four or five pills every day and say, like, I'm doing it. I'm, you know, I'm taking care of myself. And unfortunately, you know, that's all that a lot of us have time for.
And you write in your piece about how there is a spectrum here in the wellness industry, and some of it might be on the end that you're talking about, things that haven't been tested, and some where you have really well-trained, highly talented professionals working. And so, I mean, that's part of the issue with this industry having such popularity is that it hasn't been regulated yet, so it's hard to evaluate the effectiveness right now.
Yeah, you know, and there are things that people swear by that have no, that have been evaluated, and they still do them. Like, I'm thinking of juice cleanses and colonics. There's, the body is really, really good at getting rid of toxins. It's what our livers and kidneys and, you know, adrenal system, and like, we have all these different mechanisms. The human body is great at eliminating toxins. That's what that we do all day long, and it doesn't need to not consume anything except for just juice, which is really just sugar, or that weird lemonade cayenne thing that happens like every 4 or 5 years. It comes back like clockwork. That, you know, people are doing that cleanse. You know, there's no indication that that does anything good for your body. But people do it all the time. And people, you know, like, think about the Juicero craze with the juicer that got incredible investment in Silicon Valley to create this juicer that was sort of you could put these pods in and it would, you know, make fresh juice in your house that you could, you know, you subscribe to them. And, you know, number one, the whole thing, the mechanism, you could just squeeze the pods with your hands and get the same amount of juice. But number two, like, juicing is not really that great for you. It's not, you know, but it persists, this idea that that is, you know, sort of the utmost of health. And, you know, all over the country, people will spend $8, $10, $12 for a 12-ounce juice.
And
that, to me, is like,
I just want to jump in. We're about out of time, but I want to get your take before we let you go in about 30 seconds here. Do you think that mainstream medicine picks up its cue and sees that there is demand for the kind of services and care that wellness offers?
I mean, I think that that is a trend right now. I think that patient-centered medicine and trying to connect with patients, because the outcomes are better and the costs are lower. I mean, there are, you know, sort of big corporate reasons to embrace, you know, if not every element of wellness, that sort of, you know, the feeling that it creates, the feeling of warmth and that you were listened to, you know, and hopefully that will also address some of the systemic, you know, sexism that exists in the system.
Annalise, thanks so much for joining us. Annalise Griffin, writer and editor. You can read her piece on Quartz Magazine up on the Central Time Facebook page. Last week, we shared a story about a circus world elephant escaping from her barn, probably after her companion opened the lock with her trunk. And afterwards, the Asian elephant named Kelly wandered through the backyards of a residential neighborhood near Circus World Museum. Reportedly, Kelly took her time, stopped to munch on trees and other green stuff before she got returned to Circus World. Well, you loved that story. You read it on our Facebook page, and you had a lot to say about it, too. Jan said exactly what I was thinking, which is that I'd love to have an elephant in my backyard. How cool would that be? Charlie used the opportunity to go a little crazy with the puns and other elephant-based humor. He said, I suppose his freedom was quickly truncated by his capture. Get it? Truncated. He also said, what a circus. I'll bet he'll never forget today. And I get it. Elephants have good memories. And Barbara shared a little story. She said, I was looking out the window of my friend's third floor condo in India when I saw an elephant walking down the street. I was alarmed and ran to tell my friends. They told me elephants are friendly like dogs. If you treat them right, they're very safe and can be walked down the street. And Nancy summed it all up, said probably the best day of that elephant's life. Well, here's hoping that the elephant Kelly and her friend Isla in Baraboo are having a great 4th of July. I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time.